Christians that were earlier active, lost and missionary, had by now passed from the scene, and two new generations that were earlier unborn, Boom and 13th, had now arrived. This awakening, this society-wide obsession with breaking rules, celebrating the spirit, and shedding social discipline, again defined generations, but in ways entirely unlike the earlier crisis. Back in World War II, 65-year-olds were moralist visionaries. Now, in the Consciousness Revolution, they were defenders of a rationalist establishment. Before, 45-year-olds were hard-scrabble midlife pragmatists. Now they were sensitive navigators of midlife passages. Before, 25-year-olds were uniformed soldiers. Now they were preachy narcissists. And the children? Gone were the sheltered goody-two-shoes. In their place were latchkey kids growing up hard. Every 40 years or so, the persona of each phase of life becomes nearly the opposite of that established by the generation that had once passed through it. Dating back to the start of modernity, this rhythm has been at work. It is incorrect to suppose, as some do, that most young generations come of age with similar attitudes towards life, elders, politics, culture, that their elders once had when young. Going back 500 years, this has never happened. Generational aging is what translates the rhythm of the past into the rhythm of the future. It explains why each generation is not only shaped by history, but also shapes later history. It regulates the velocity of social change. It connects life in its biographical intimacy to history in its social or political grandeur. In all these ways, the generation lies at the root of the saeculum. In 1992, when news weeklies and TV ads suddenly began to focus on Generation X, the American popular culture broke a long silence on the question of whether any new youth had arrived, a silence that had lasted since the end of the Vietnam War. Through two whole decades, no one had given the question much thought because no new generation seemed to be rising. But then, in the 90s, the topic was back in the news. So has it always been. Roughly once every 20 years, America discovers a new generation, a happenstance triggered by some striking event in which young people appear to behave in ways manifestly different than the youth who came just before. The generational birth years also coincide with the secular rhythm of alternating crises and awakenings. When you compare dates, you will find that the first birth year of each generation usually lies just a couple of years before the opening or closing year of a crisis or awakening. Finally, notice the recurring pattern within each saeculum. The first generation comes of age with an awakening, while the second has an awakening childhood. The third comes of age with a crisis, while the fourth has a crisis childhood. Each of these four locations in history is associated with a generational archetype: prophet, nomad, hero, and artist. Throughout Anglo-American history, with only one exception, the Civil War, when the hero was skipped, these archetypes have always followed each other in the same order. Due to this recurring pattern, America has always had the same generational constellation during every crisis or awakening. That is, the same archetypal lineup entering the four phases of life. But what are the archetypes that are so predictably created by their location in history? How do they function? How do they relate to each other? Why do they lie so near the heart of mankind's interaction with history? Answering these questions means journeying back to the ancient doctrine of quaternal temperaments and to the great myths that arose alongside them. In the view of Swiss psychologist Carl Jung, certain symbols, aspirations, and behavioral modes, archetypes, are biologically hardwired into mankind. In all eras and cultures, he said, these archetypes have become so deeply embedded in mankind's collective unconscious that no degree of progress, real or imagined, could weaken their grip. Identifying these archetypes by probing dreams and myths, Jung fashioned his theory after the ancient quaternities. His four archetypal functions draw energy from the dynamic antagonism between two sets of opposites, thinking versus feeling, sensing versus intuiting. When one function dominates the psyche, its opposite is necessarily suppressed as the psyche's shadow. Though archetypes are ordinarily applied only to individual personalities, they can also be extended to generations. Like an individual, A generation is shaped by the nurture it receives in childhood and the challenges it faces coming of age. When it assumes a persona, a generation, like an individual, can choose from only a limited number of possible roles, each prescripted by a societal collective unconscious. Myth is the raw outline of the archetype itself. In any era, mythical archetypes assist people's understanding of who they are and what they should live up to. Margaret Mitchell constructed myths from the Civil War, Shakespeare from the War of the Roses, and Homer from some otherwise forgotten skirmish in the Dardanelles. By converting events into myths, a culture can transcend chaotic or linear history and allow the instinct for reenactment to express itself. The myths that endure are those that illuminate the virtues or vices that successive generations see recurring in their own time. Of all myths, the most widely noticed is the hero myth. But heroes can be secular or spiritual. They can possess what Jung calls either extroverted or introverted behavior. There are two types of deed, insists Joseph Campbell in The Power of Myth. One is the physical deed, in which the hero performs a courageous act in battle or saves a life. The other is the spiritual deed, in which the hero learns to experience the supernatural range of human spiritual life and then comes back with the message. The secular hero king and spiritual hero prophet often appear in the same myth, yet when they do, they are never the same age, not even close. Typically, they are two phases of life apart. In legends where the young hero king makes his perilous journey, his first encounter is often with what Campbell describes as a protective figure, often a little old crone or old man, who provides the adventurer with amulets against the dragon forces he is about to pass. The prophet can be a ritual elder, holy man, or what Campbell calls a shaman, a person who has undergone a spiritually transforming rite of passage and, entering old age, uses the powers thereby gained to assist the young. This elder possesses little worldly power, but supernatural gifts of magic and access to the gods. Even today, this timeless tale continues to be retold, as Disney's Apprentice and the Sorcerer, The Hobbit's Bilbo Baggins and Gandalf, Star Wars' Luke Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi, and The Lion King's Simba and Rafiki. For the young hero, the elder prophet is not necessarily an ally. He, or often she, can also be a lethal enemy, as Medusa was for Jason, or as the crone sorcerers were in Snow White and The Wizard of Oz. Yet more often, as Campbell notes, the young hero's close bond with a wise elder is essential to his ultimate success. Like Merlin, he will be a loving teacher. Like Obi-Wan Kenobi, he will feel the unseen force of the universe. Like Gandalf, he will rescue the young hero through mysterious mental powers. Like Mickey's sorcerer, he will warn against the dangers of hubris. In the end, the old prophet helps the young king found or save his dynasty. Myths involving young hero kings and old prophets are universal in part because people are comforted to hear tales of the valor of youth tempered by the wisdom of age. Yet people of all eras know that such a myth-like symbiosis between young and old occurs only on occasion. In America, certainly, it has not been present for decades. The last time heroic youth and wise elders had this kind of constructive relationship was during World War II. The reason these young hero myths are so embedded in our civilization is because they explain events when the secular world, the domain of kings, is being redefined beyond prior recognition, in other words, in crisis eras. Another popular type of myth, that of the young prophet and the old king, is much the opposite. These legends tell not of the founding of kingdoms, but of religions. They invoke memories not of a world threatened by dire peril, but of a world suffocating under mighty dynasties that have become oversecure and soul dead. They speak to the insight, not valor, of youth, and the blindness, not wisdom, of elders. When we encounter sacred myths of young prophets, Abraham and Ur, Moses in Egypt, Jesus before the Roman magistrate, the dominant image of persons roughly 40 years older is typically one of expansive wealth and rationalism, resplendent in power but bereft of values, Hammurabi, the Pharaoh, Pontius Pilate. While the hero myth ends in the palatial city, the prophet myth starts there. In the Buddhist myth, young Siddhartha escapes the sumptuous pleasure dome of his royal father. In Persian myth, young Zoroaster defies the two-worldly Kavis and Karpans. In Islamic lore, young Muhammad challenges the immorality of the rich merchant families. In Western fables, young Bacchus puts the gold curse on old King Midas, and the Pied Piper steals the youth away from the stolid burghers of Hamelin. These prophet myths revealed what Jung would call the shadow of the aging hero archetype. The hero is seen not through his own eyes, but through the fresh vision of the youth prophet. The one who sees that the emperor has no clothes is not one of the emperor's own peers, but a child who dares to speak the truth. The recurring tone of these myths is one of stress and hostility across the generations. By teaching lessons about vision, or self-centeredness, among the young, and power, or corruption, among the old, these young prophet myths speak of awakening eras. Myths evoking the nomad and artist are less grand and more personal, mainly because they encounter history's turning points at a less critical phase of life. These archetypes encounter their first turning point not coming of age, but growing up as children. They encounter their second turning point not entering the peak of elder power, but entering midlife. Compared to the hero and prophet myths, their tales speak more to human relations than to the rise and fall of dynasties and religions. Yet they too embody shadow life cycles that mirror each other. Nomads are abandoned and alienated children who later, as adults, strive to slow down, simplify, embrace their social environment. Artists are sheltered and sensitive children who later, as adults, strive to speed up, complicate, and adorn their social environment. Nomads are raised to manage alone and are burdened with low expectations. Artists are raised to cooperate with others and are burdened with high expectations. One common storyline features a Cinderella-like hated child, immersed in a hostile or neglectful social environment, who must apply competitive instincts first to survive, then to succeed. In similar myths, hardscrabble youths must use their wits to evade murder, Aladdin, cannibalism, Hansel and Gretel, slavery, Pinocchio, or meltdown, toy soldier. Parental figures are typically missing, and the enemies are less often elders than prime-of-life people possessed of a ruthless vanity. If aging people are wizards, they are friendly helpmates, more like fairies than sorcerers, their powers flowing from whimsical kindness more than stern wisdom. These myths depict the child nomad being nurtured by an older artist amidst darker sides of an awakening. When a myth shows the nomad archetype in midlife, the story tells of an aging adventurer, savvy but going it alone. If older generations are present, they represent an older prophet and a younger hero, never the other way around. The nomad is neither as dutiful or naive as the younger hero, nor as transcendentally wise or wicked as the older prophet. The best the nomad can hope to experience is a brush with others' greatness. In the Star Wars trilogy, Han Solo looks down the age ladder and sees the good Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia, and looks up and sees the wise Obi-Wan Kenobi and the evil Darth Vader. These are times of crisis, during which the nomad does the dirty work with little expectation of public praise or reward. The opposing child myth is that of the sensitive, dutiful youth enveloped in protections constructed by no-nonsense adults. Recall the classic myth of the little Dutch boy doing his small part to save the mighty dike, or in anthropomorphic tales of sweetly vulnerable little animals, Bambi, Peter Cottontail, or machines, the little engine that could. These myths depict children who look for ways to be helpful in a closed social environment where do's and don'ts are unquestioned. Sometimes adults have built such an impenetrable perimeter of protection that the outer world is invisible. Uncle Remus, Winnie the Pooh. Relations across generations are harmonious. Where the emotional timbre of the young nomad stories is blunt and horrifying, here it is subtle and heartwarming. These myths depict the child artist being nurtured by an older nomad. Looking carefully through a child's prism, we can recognize the possibility, Christopher Robin, if not the fact, little Dutch boy, that the adult world is in crisis. In these four archetypal myths, you can recognize two sets of opposing temperaments, as well as two sets of inverted life cycles. When multiple generations enter the myths, you typically see the nomad sandwiched between the younger hero and the older prophet, and the artist between the younger prophet and the elder hero. This same archetypal ordering arises again and again in nearly every time and culture. Why? A society will not elevate an event or story into myth unless it illustrates enduring human tendencies. This ordering reflects a latent understanding of the shadow suppressed within each archetype. Were it possible for generations to come in some different order, say from hero to prophet to artist to nomad, it would be much harder for the shadows to reveal themselves, or for a society to have that enantiodromia that enables civilization to correct its worst excesses. What Jung observed about individuals is also true for generations. Each archetype's shadow is best revealed by the one directly across the cycle, two phases of life distant. The two sanguine aging heroes are countered by the fresh insights of young prophets. The two melancholic aging prophets by the valor of young heroes. The two phlegmatic aging nomads by the sensitivity of young artists. And the two choleric aging artists by the survival skills of young nomads. This sequence further explains the oft-noted similarities between very old and very young generations, whose location in time lies a full cycle apart. The affinity between grandparent and grandchild is universal folk wisdom. Your generation isn't like the generation that shaped you, but it has much in common with the generation that shaped the generation that shaped you. This critical cross-cycle relationship is just what we see in most societies. It arises because a new child generation gathers its first impressions about the world, just as a new midlife generation gains control of the institutions that surround a child. Even though a child's biological parents will be distributed about equally over the two prior generations, because generations average about 21 years in length, the older parental group has the dominant role. Boomers were parented by GIs and silent, but the GIs exerted a far greater power over 1950s-era schools, PTAs, pediatric advice, TV, and movies. In the 1990s, similarly, boomers and 13ers are together giving birth to millennial children. But the tone is set by Bill Bennett, Hillary Clinton, Steven Spielberg, Bill Gates, and their boomer peers. Likewise, the lost Norman Rockwells set the tone for the silent, and the silent Bill Cosbys for 13ers. Just as 13er Jodie Foster's will set the tone for the generation born early next century. Move up one phase of life notch, and this pattern repeats. When a child generation comes of age, it does so just as that older generation enters elderhood and gains control of the institutions surrounding the young adult's world. A younger generation reaches military age just as its cross-cycle shadow reaches maximum power to declare war. In American history, for instance, a generation's dominance in national leadership posts typically peaks around the time its first cohorts reach age 65. Just as foot soldiers are on average about 42 years, or two phases of life younger. The GIs fought in missionary-declared World War II. The silent in the lost-declared Korean War. Boomers in the GI-declared Vietnam War. And 13ers in silent-declared Desert Storm. The reaction of each archetype to its shadow can be friendly or antagonistic. Intentionally or not, most parents enter midlife trying to raise a new generation whose collective persona will complement and not mirror their own. Later on, however, the results of that nurture often come as a surprise. The GI pediatrician Benjamin Spock declared just after World War II that we need idealistic children, and his peers raised boomers accordingly, though many later voiced anger over the narcissistic product. Silent Generation author Judy Blume wrote at the height of the consciousness revolution that, I hate the idea that you should always protect children. And her peers raised 13er children accordingly, though many later voiced anguish over the hardened product. A key consequence of these cross-cycle shadow relationships is a recurring pattern that lies at the heart of the saeculum, an oscillation between the overprotection and underprotection of children. As the parental generation enters elderhood blind to its shadow, the child generation comes of age, emerges as the shadow, and reacts against its elders' perceived excesses. When this rhythm is filled out with the full range of historical examples, a four-type cycle of generations emerges. Let us begin with the prophet archetype, the one born in the secular spring. A prophet generation grows up as increasingly indulged post-crisis children, comes of age as the narcissistic young crusaders of an awakening, cultivates principle as moralistic midlifers, and emerges as wise elders guiding the next crisis. A nomad generation grows up as underprotected children during an awakening, comes of age as the alienated young adults of a post-awakening world, mellows into pragmatic midlife leaders during a crisis, and ages into tough post-crisis elders. A hero generation grows up as increasingly protected post-awakening children, comes of age as the heroic young team workers of a crisis, demonstrates hubris as energetic midlifers, and emerges as powerful awakening elders attacked by the next awakening. An artist generation grows up as overprotected children during a crisis, comes of age as the sensitive young adults of a post-crisis world, breaks free as indecisive midlife leaders during an awakening, and ages into empathic post-awakening elders. Has anybody noticed this four-type cycle before? Yes, many times over the millennia. But at no other place and time in human history has the cycle of generations propelled this wheel of time with more force than in America. Mount Rushmore's granite is a monument to four great American leaders. Born over a span of 126 years, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Theodore Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln represent four different generations: liberty, republican, progressive, transcendental. But the mountain depicts more than that. Looking from left to right, the visitor sees permanent testimony to the best-regarded president of each archetype, chiseled not in chronological order, but in secular order: nomad, hero, artist, and prophet. In the vision of Rushmore sculptor Gutzon Borglum, the power of archetypal myths asserted itself once again. Millions of Americans have sensed in this monument a magnificently balanced rendering of their national history. Some generations are remembered for championing great principles, others for building great institutions. Some are remembered for pragmatism and boldness, others for learning and flexibility. These four archetypes, nomad, hero, artist, and prophet, have lent balance and self-correction to the continuing story of America. Were our ancestral legacy to have had too much or too little of any of the four, we would today be poorer for it. As you will recall, a turning is an era with a characteristic social mood, a new twist on how people feel about themselves and their nation. It results from the aging of the generational constellation. A society enters a turning once every 20 years or so, when all living generations begin to enter the next phases of life. Like archetypes and constellations, turnings come forward to a saeculum, and always in the same order. The first turning is a high. The second turning is an awakening. The third turning is an unraveling. The fourth turning is a crisis. Like the four seasons of nature, the four turnings of history are equally necessary and important. They comprise a quaternal social cycle of growth, maturity, entropy, and death, and rebirth. In a spring-like high, a society fortifies and builds and converges in an era of promise. In a summer-like awakening, it dreams and plays and exults in an era of euphoria. In an autumnal unraveling, it harvests and consumes and diverges in an era of anxiety. In a hibernal crisis, it focuses and struggles and sacrifices in an era of survival. When the saeculum is in motion, therefore, no long human lifetime can go by without a society confronting its deepest spiritual and worldly needs. Let's take a closer look at the first turning. Old prophets disappear. Nomads enter elderhood. Heroes enter midlife. Artists enter young adulthood, and a new generation of prophets is born. A high brings a renaissance to community life. With a new civic order in place, people want to put the crisis behind them and feel content about what they have collectively achieved. Any social issues left unresolved by the crisis must now remain so. The need for dutiful sacrifice has ebbed, yet the society continues to demand order and consensus. The recent fear for group survival transmutes into a desire for investment, growth, and strength, which in turn produces an era of commercial prosperity, institutional solidarity, and political stability. Life tends towards the friendly and homogeneous, but attitudes towards personal risk-taking begin to loosen. The sense of shame, which rewards duty and conformity, reaches its zenith. Gender distinctions attain their widest point, and child-rearing becomes more indulgent. Wars are unlikely, except as unwanted echoes of the recent crisis. Eventually, civic life seems fully under control but distressingly spirit-dead. People worry that, as a society, they can do everything but no longer feel anything. The post-World War II American high may rank as the all-time apogee of the national mood. Recall America's circa 1963 conception of the future. We brimmed over with optimism about Camelot, a bustling future with smart people in which big projects and impossible dreams were freshly achievable. The moon could be reached and poverty eradicated, both within a decade. The future had specificity and certainty, but lacked urgency and moral direction. Next, let's examine the second turning. Old nomads disappear. Heroes enter elderhood. Artists enter midlife. Prophets enter young adulthood. And a new generation of child nomads is born. An awakening arrives with a dramatic challenge against the high's assumptions about benevolent reason and congenial institutions. The outer world now feels trivial compared to the inner world. New spiritual agendas and social ideals burst forth. The prosperity and security of a high are overtly disdained, though covertly taken for granted. A society searches for soul over science, meanings over things. Youth-fired attacks break out against the established institutional order. People stop believing that social progress requires social discipline. Public order deteriorates, and crime and substance abuse rise. Gender distinctions narrow, and child-rearing reaches the point of minimum protection and structure. Any public effort that requires collective discipline encounters withering controversy. Wars are awkwardly fought and badly remembered afterward. Eventually, the enthusiasm cools, having left the old cultural regime fully discredited, internal enemies identified, comity shattered, and institutions delegitimized. Many Americans recall this mood on the campuses and urban streets of the consciousness revolution. Earlier generations knew a similar mood in Greenwich Village around 1900, in utopian communes around 1840, in the Connecticut Valley nearly a century earlier, and in the Puritans' New Jerusalems in the post-Mayflower decades. Now let's examine the third turning. Old heroes disappear. Artists enter elderhood. Prophets enter midlife. Nomads enter young adulthood, and a new generation of child heroes is born. An unraveling begins as a society-wide embrace of the liberating cultural forces set loose by the awakening. People have had their fill of spiritual rebirth, moral reform, and lifestyle experimentation. Content with what they have become individually, they vigorously assert an ethos of pragmatism, self-reliance, laissez-faire, and national or sectional or ethnic chauvinism. While personal satisfaction is high, public trust ebbs amid a fragmenting culture, harsh debates over values, and weakening civic habits. Pleasure-seeking lifestyles coexist with a declining public tolerance for aberrant personal behavior. The sense of guilt, which rewards principle and individuality, reaches its zenith. Gender differences attain their narrowest point. Families stabilize, and new protections are provided for children. As moral debates brew, the big public arguments are over ends, not means. Decisive public action becomes very difficult, as community problems are deferred. Wars are fought with moral fervor, but without consensus or follow-through. Eventually, cynical alienation hardens into a brooding pessimism. The approaching specter of public disaster ultimately elicits a mix of paralysis and apathy. People can now feel, but collectively can no longer do. The mood of the current culture wars era seems new to nearly every living American, but is not new to history. Around World War I, America steeped in reform and fundamentalism amid a flood tide of crime, alcohol, immigration, political corruption, and circus trials. The 1850s likewise simmered with moral righteousness, shortening tempers, and multiplying mavericks. It was a decade, says historian David Donald, in which the authority of all government in America was at a low point. Entering the 1760s, the colonies felt rejuvenated in spirit, but reeled from violence, mobs, insurrections, and paranoia over the corruption of official authority. Finally, let's look at the fourth turning. Old artists disappear. Prophets enter elderhood. Nomads enter midlife. Heroes enter young adulthood. And a new generation of child artists is born. A crisis arises in response to sudden threats that previously would have been ignored or deferred, but which are now perceived as dire. Great worldly perils boil off the clutter and complexity of life, leaving behind one simple imperative: the society must prevail. People support new efforts to wield public authority, whose perceived successes soon justify more of the same. Government governs, community obstacles are removed, and laws and customs that resisted change for decades are swiftly shunted aside. A grim preoccupation with civic peril causes spiritual curiosity to decline. A sense of public urgency contributes to a clampdown on bad conduct or antisocial lifestyles. Public order strengthens, private risk-taking abates, and crime and substance abuse decline. Families strengthen, gender distinctions widen, and child-rearing reaches a smothering degree of protection and structure. The young focus their energy on worldly achievements, leaving values in the hands of the old. Wars are fought with fury and for maximum result. Eventually, the mood transforms into one of exhaustion and optimism. Buoyed by a newborn faith in the group and in authority, leaders plan, people hope, and a society yearns for good and simple things. Today's older Americans recognize this as the mood of the Great Depression and World War II, but a similar mood has been present in all the other great gates of our history, from the Civil War and American Revolution back into colonial and English history. Each of these turnings has made its own contribution to history. Each offered its own solutions, which, in time, created new problems and anxieties. Thus have the four turnings kept the great wheel of time in motion, infusing civilization with periodic new doses of vitality, propelling the human adventure ever forward. Most Americans like to think that we are total masters of our destiny, exempt from all cycles, able to choose whatever we desire, whenever we desire it. And in some cases, we are. But does that freedom mean that our desires are unpredictable? Marketers and pollsters don't think so, which is why they spend billions learning how to anticipate when people will want to buy certain kinds of products or vote for certain kinds of candidates. The statistical reliability of these patterns doesn't nullify human freedom. The same principle applies to the saeculum. It doesn't force anybody to do anything. It merely explains when most people will want to push their own lives more in one direction than in another. Even if a cycle of history does not violate free will, some troublesome questions remain. They go by the name of fortune, chaos, or accident. How can the saeculum coexist with all of history's chance events and trends? Who could have predicted the steamship and locomotive, or the stock crash on Black Tuesday, or the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, or the accuracy of Lee Harvey Oswald's bullet, or the invention of the microcomputer? How can any theory of social change predict such things? The answer is simple. The saeculum neither predicts them nor precludes them. Yes, history always dishes out accidents. All the saeculum insists is that what matters most are not the accidents themselves, but rather society's response to them. To understand how this works, select an accident, transport it to another decade, and try to replay its effect. Move the Watergate break-in back 40 years. Would circa 1934 America have been receptive to a pair of GI reporters eager to bring down a missionary president recently elected by an enormous landslide? Of course not. Or move the Great Depression forward 40 years. Would circa 1974 boomers have coped with economic bust by cheerfully donning uniforms, joining paramilitary public works programs, and building a TVA? Again, not likely. Many experts today claim that technology has become an autonomous force, by itself determining the pace and direction of major social trends. They insist that television is turning Americans into a society of 1,000 niche channels, ensconcing people in private cocoons and dissolving the glue of civic life. They say that computers are enthroning the individual and undermining social authority, and that a cyberspaced information revolution is overwhelming governments, globalizing the economy, and rendering national borders irrelevant. All these arguments have some merit. But since these trends are what we would expect in an unraveling anyway, we should wonder, do these new technologies really change us? Or do they just give us precisely what we want, when we want it? 40 years ago, the cathode ray technology we call television was widely considered to be a homogenizing tool that molded national opinions around the consensus messages of Walter Cronkite and Ed Sullivan. Now TV does just the opposite. 40 years ago, the organized transistor technology we know as the computer conjured up jackbooted images of Big Brother. The whole paradigm for this technology was a mainframe atop an information pyramid. Now computers symbolize just the opposite. Today's dominant paradigm for this technology is the decentralized personal station plugged into a participatory network. More often than not, technology tailors itself to the national mood. When automobiles, telephones, and radios were still new on the eve of World War I, they were regarded as inventions that would individualize and fragment American life by separating rich from poor, facilitating privacy, and allowing people to travel and vacation anywhere. And so they did, for a while. Then, with the convoys and propaganda machines of World War II, these same technologies symbolized civic purpose. By the 1950s, they helped standardize a middle-class lifestyle. By the 1970s, they were endlessly attacked as symbols of dehumanizing conformity. Today, these technologies have again shifted back to suit an unraveling mood. Witness the popularity of 4x4 getaway vehicles, cellular phones, and niche radio. The linearist view of technology fails to appreciate the dangers a new turning can bring. Microsoft founder Bill Gates is now predicting that everyone will soon tune into a world of unlimited options via high-tech portable devices. What he nowhere mentions is that by merely reversing a few circuits, the same technology could empower a central authority to monitor what every individual is doing. Consider a few other technologies Americans have recently associated with individual choice, birth control and genetic testing, and imagine a similar shift for them. While few Americans want to revisit the forced sterilization and eugenics vogue of the 1930s, we would be imprudent to declare that a higher-tech America will never again lurch in that direction. While technologies appear as gradual trends, other wildcards of history appear with catastrophic suddenness, often with names and faces attached. To those who perceive time as chaos, this patternless clatter of serendipities bangs away at a pace that may seem essentially random. For the 20th century, a chaoticist might cite the likes of Adolf Hitler, Ho Chi Minh, Lee Harvey Oswald, and Timothy McVeigh. But reflect on whether these sparks of history and the national response to them are really independent of the saeculum. What about Hitler? Americans might congratulate themselves by thinking he would have provoked our nation into war in any era. But would he do so now, during an unraveling? Maybe not. Ho Chi Minh? Definitely not. Oswald? Though a deranged act could, of course, happen at any time, most political assassination attempts in U.S. history have, in fact, happened during awakenings. McVeigh? Recall how much less consensus there was in the late 1960s about the evilness of radical bombings. History always produces sparks, but some sparks flare and then vanish, while others touch off firestorms out of any proportion to the sparks themselves. History always produces good and bad ideas. Some quickly dissipate, while others become great inspirations or horrible scourges. The history of American reactions to foreign provocations is filled with such contrasts. Compare, for example, America's involvement in World War I and World War II. Both wars were preceded by aggressive foreign acts, the sinking of the Lusitania, the air attack on Pearl Harbor. In one case, Congress waited 2 years and patiently endured further provocations before declaring war amid significant political opposition. In the other case, it declared war the next day, and did so with only a single dissenting vote. In one case, the war helped inflame divisive issues like prohibition, labor violence, and sedition trials. In the other, the nation mobilized with no distractions. Both wars ended in total victory. In one case, soldiers came home to moral nagging and vice squads. In the other, to ticker tape parades. Both wars strengthened America's influence overseas. In one case, that influence was quickly squandered. In the other, it was consolidated over the next two decades. During a fourth turning, generational forces tend to funnel exogenous events towards a concerted national response. When Hitler and Tojo launched their global aggressions, America was poised for decisive action. With prophets in power and heroes coming of age, the archetypal order givers were in charge and the archetypal order takers were on the battlefield. The result was maximum cooperation between generations. Elder prophet leaders do not back down from confrontation. Indeed, Sam Adams, John Brown, and FDR have all been plausibly accused of helping to stage a crisis for the express purpose of galvanizing younger people. Halfway across the saeculum, no war can escape the cross-currents of a youth-fired awakening. During the Vietnam War, the archetypal order takers were old, the order givers young. Young prophets challenged the moral emptiness of the institutions directing them. Meanwhile, elder heroes did everything they could to preempt the need for sacrifice, if necessary by means of sheer affluence and technology. The result was maximum convulsion between generations. During the late 1960s, both generations were ill at ease in their war-waging roles, each displeasing the other with its behavior. Every major war in Anglo-American history has been shaped by the turning during which it arose. Does the rhythm of the saeculum make a war cycle unavoidable? No one knows. An awakening does not require a war, nor, perhaps, does a crisis, even though every fourth turning since the 15th century has culminated in total war. History teaches only that whatever wars do happen always reflect the mood of the current turning. Wars in a fourth turning find the broadest possible definition and are fought to unambiguous outcomes. Since the saeculum is at work to some degree throughout the modern world, however, it may well say something about when America is likely to encounter what sort of allies or adversaries abroad. Soon after the American Revolution, a fledgling U.S. republic was probably fortunate that the old world was entirely absorbed in its own crisis, its own age of revolution. The same could be said of the 1860s. While America fought the Civil War, Europe and Japan were busy with their own wars of nation-building. VE Day, VJ Day, and the creation of the Iron Curtain were profound fourth-turning events throughout most of the world. As such, the saeculum's timing among different societies probably became better synchronized after World War II than ever before in modern history. Today's archetypal constellations all around the world show striking similarities. At the top are the elders whom everyone still associates with civic trust and big institutions, and who have recently passed from power amid fears that their strong, if bullying, hand on the national tiller cannot be replaced. Peers of America's GI generation, they are known as the generation of the Long March, Deng Xiaoping, of the Blitz, Margaret Thatcher, of the Resistance, François Mitterrand, Giulio Andreotti, and of the Patriotic War, Leonid Brezhnev, Yuri Andropov. Taking their place as leaders is a grown-up air raid generation of war children, the likes of Boris Yeltsin, Helmut Kohl, Jacques Chirac, Jean Chrétien, and Romano Prodi. Postmodern experts who tout glasnost, diplomacy, communication, and bureaucracy while all the old alliances meander and splinter. Behind them comes the global generation that came of age amid youth riots, the invasion of Prague, Euro-terrorism, and the Chinese Cultural Revolution. In Europe, this is the 50-ish generation of 1968. Alexander Lebed, Lech Walesa, Gerry Adams, Prince Charles. In Israel, this is the post-Exodus generation of Benjamin Netanyahu. Anti-establishment, values-obsessed, resistant to Western pop culture, and drawn to angry partisans, the boomers' foreign counterparts have thus far been very slow coming to power. Their era of leadership still lies mostly ahead. As for today's youthful 90s generation, in France the BOF generation, as in Who Cares, the global media are dishing out the following descriptors: fun-loving and rootless, environmentalist and entrepreneurial, pragmatic and market-oriented, globalist economically yet xenophobic socially, and thus far profoundly uninterested in politics. From Reagan's special friendship with Thatcher to undergrad surfing the web in Seattle and Minsk, the cross-national affinity between today's generations probably ensures that Americans of leadership age will continue to encounter similar temperaments abroad for the next two or three decades at least. This may accentuate the rhythms of the saeculum and reinforce its quaternal timing, perhaps with stormier crises followed by higher highs. Then again, it may do nothing of the sort. No one knows. The saeculum is not an entirely stable social dynamic, and for a very simple reason. Total stability is beyond the reach of any human system. Now let's meet the Gray Champion, a pivotal figure in the fourth turning scenario. One afternoon in April 1689, as the American colonies boiled with rumors that King James II was about to strip them of their liberties, the king's hand-picked governor of New England, Sir Edmund Andros, marched his troops menacingly through Boston. His purpose was to crush any thought of colonial self-rule. To everyone present, the future looked grim. Just at that moment, seemingly from nowhere, there appeared on the streets the figure of an ancient man, with the eye, the face, the attitude of command. His manner, combining the leader and the saint, the old man planted himself directly in the path of the approaching British soldiers and demanded that they stop. The solemn yet warlike peal of that voice, fit either to rule a host in the battlefield or be raised to God in prayer, were irresistible. At the old man's word and outstretched arm, the roll of the drum was hushed at once, and the advancing line stood still. Inspired by this single act of defiance, the people of Boston roused their courage and acted. Within the day, Andros was deposed and jailed, the liberty of Boston saved, and the corner turned on the colonial glorious revolution. Who was this Gray Champion? Asked Nathaniel Hawthorne near the end of this story in his Twice-Told Tales. No one knew, except that he had once been among the fire-hearted young Puritans who had first settled New England more than half a century earlier. Later that evening, just before the old priest-warrior disappeared, the townspeople saw him embracing the 85-year-old Simon Bradstreet, a kindred spirit and one of the few original Puritans still alive. Would the Gray Champion ever return? I have heard, added Hawthorne, that whenever the descendants of the Puritans are to show the spirit of their sires, the old man appears again. Posterity had to wait a while before seeing him again, the length of another long human life, in fact. When 80 years had passed, wrote Hawthorne, the Gray Champion reappeared. The occasion was the revolutionary summer of 1775, when America's elders once again appealed to God, summoned the young to battle, and dared the hated enemy to fire. When our fathers were toiling at the breastwork on Bunker's Hill, Hawthorne continued, all through that night the old warrior walked his rounds. This old warrior, this graying peer of Sam Adams, or Ben Franklin, or Samuel Langdon, the Harvard president who preached to the Bunker Hill troops, had belonged to the awakening generation, whose youth had provided the spiritual taproot of the Republic secured in their old age. Hawthorne wrote this stirring legend in 1837, as a young man of 33. The Bunker Hill fathers belonged to his parents' generation, by then well into old age. The nation had new arguments over slavery, and new enemies, Mexico, but no one expected the old people of that era, the worldly likes of John Marshall and John Jacob Astor, to be playing the role of Gray Champion. Long, long may it be ere he comes again, Hawthorne prophesied. His hour is one of darkness and adversity and peril. But should domestic tyranny oppress us, or the invader's step pollute our soil, still may the Gray Champion come. Although Hawthorne did not say when this would be, perhaps he should have been able to tell. A quarter century later, his peers, the generation of Abraham Lincoln, would know the answer. We may prefer to see ourselves as masters of nature, controllers of all change and progress, exempt from the seasons of history. Yet the more we balk at seasonality and the more we try to eradicate it, the more menacing we render our view of time and the future. Most of today's Americans grew up in a society whose citizens dreamed of perpetually improving outcomes, better jobs, fatter wallets, stronger government, finer culture, nicer families, smarter kids, all the usual fruits of progress. Today, deep into a third turning, these goals often feel like they are slipping away. Many of us wish we could rewind time, but we know we can't, and we fear for our children and grandchildren. In a sense, Americans resemble a primitive people who, feeling the dry chill of a deepening autumn, grow nostalgic for spring while wondering how, or even if, the moist warmth will ever arrive again. Many Americans wish that, somehow, they could bring back a secular spring now. But seasons don't work that way. As in nature, a secular autumn can be warm or cool, long or short, but the leaves will surely fall. The secular winter can hurry or wait, but history warns that it will surely be upon us. We may not wish the great champion to come again, but come he must, and come he will. The next leg of your journey is part history, part prophecy. It begins with the end of World War II, runs through the present, and extends into the old age of today's young adults. You will relearn recent American history from a seasonal perspective, as the confluence of familiar lives and times. You will learn about the mood shifts that followed the gateway years of the middle 1940s, 1960s, and 1980s. You will reacquaint yourself with today's generations, as archetypes that shift into a new constellation with each new turning. You will learn what this could mean in the next fourth turning. This time, the history lesson will be your own life story. Now let's take a closer look at our most recent first turning, the American High, 1946 to 1964. On VJ Day, August 15, 1945, peace had been declared, but America remained mobilized for total war. The nation had been locked in crisis for as long as anyone could remember, and the landscape looked it. Harbors bristled with warships, highways with convoys, depots with war materiel.